Okay, I see we're already streaming live, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. It's 1 o'clock. Thanks to everybody who's joined us for this internet seminar on tackling the carbon footprint at pump and treat projects, a case study in energy efficiency. As you, for those of you who have already logged on, you'll see that there's on the main page, you have the agenda for today's talk, the information on the presenters. I invite you to click on the names. They link to little short profiles. Let me go ahead and introduce ourselves briefly. I am Carlos Patron with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I will be introducing and moderating the speakers and the session. The main speakers are Dorothy Allen. Dorothy is with the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. She is a project manager at the site that we'll be talking about, that's Baird & McGuire. She's the person that contacted us requesting options for technical support and helping her seek energy efficiencies at this project. So this in a seminar is a result of about a year and 2 months of work that has gone into working with her on this site. So we're excited to be able to share this the knowledge that's been acquired and where we are, and lessons learned and questions yet to be answered. But anyway, the third speaker that you have up there is Doug Sutton. Doug is with Geotrans, a company with whom we have worked for a while now in performing remedial system evaluations, particularly of pump and treat systems. And a lot of the knowledge that's been acquired through that process has been applied to the Baird & McGuire projects that we'll be looking at. So with that, I ask that everybody go to the first page on the of the seminar. That is the title. I just gave you a little bit of background on the speakers. Again, you have more information on the speakers at clicking on the names on the first page of the internet seminar. A couple of points. As you may already know, we will archive this internet seminar, and it will probably be available in 1 to 2 weeks from the Kluwen Internet Seminar Archives. Let's go to slide number 2, please. One quick check. Doug Sutton, have you been able to join us yet?
Yes, I'm here, Carlos.
Great. Thank you, Doug. So today's topics, as I mentioned just a couple of seconds ago, what we'll be presenting today is the results of the work that the US EPA, Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, has done in collaboration and working with Dorothy Allen of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, the collaborative work we did to address energy challenges and reduce greenhouse gases at a specific project. We think there's a lot of value in this discussion, in sharing this knowledge with you, because a lot of the work that you have seen or heard about related to green remediation, often it's in the abstract and in the best practices. Well, in this case, we hope to be able to share with you some actual quantitative analysis of at a pump and treat project. So we'll be sharing with you a summary of the technical issues and the approach that was used at this Superfund site, which is now managed by the state of Massachusetts, and that is currently using a pump and treat technology. I'll take the opportunity to highlight what we've often said in the past. The green remediation, the concept is not to shut down pump and treat systems because they use a lot of energy. The concept is, while in some situations that may be necessary, what we're pursuing is opportunities to reduce the environmental footprint of the work that needs to be done to clean up contaminated sites. In this case, how can we operate this pump and treat system more efficiently? Originally, we had considered options such as using renewables to power the system, but ultimately it was determined that combined heat and power using potentially natural gas, while it's not a renewable energy, it did provide very good options for increasing the overall efficiency of the system and potential for reducing costs, and certainly the carbon footprint of the system as a whole. So again, we believe that a lot of the knowledge that has been acquired and developed in working on this project is important to advancing the base of information available for the application of green remediation across programs and approaches to clean up contaminated sites. So if we go to slide number 3, I'm going to assume that many of you are familiar with this slide by now. If you've participated in green remediation seminars in the past or presentations, if not, on the front page of the Cluens page of today's internet seminar, you'll see that we've listed all the internet seminars that have been given so far on this topic. So you're free to, as you know, those are archived. You can go back and listen to them and page through the presentations and hear the speakers. But to be real brief on this slide, a couple of things we want to emphasize, of course, on the energy and air side. A lot of the focus of today's presentation will be on those two topics, on reducing the energy needed to operate this system, reducing air emissions, but mostly reducing the greenhouse gas footprint of operating the system. So what is the technical potential for achieving reductions in energy and the carbon footprint? That's what we'll be looking at today. If you go to slide number 4, this, of course, fits in with the overall OSWRB. OSWRB, for those of you who are not familiar with it, although I suspect most of you do know that, it's the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. Thank you. I was thinking about the OSWRB acronym, Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. So anyway, why do we say this? Because the strategies that we're pursuing, they apply to all cleanup programs, and a lot of the knowledge that's developed here is applicable to any cleanup program. While I personally work in the Superfund program, I work with a lot of peers in different efforts in green remediation, and it's a common understanding that the technical information that's acquired through these efforts is applicable to all cleanup programs. So this effort, of course, is one to benchmark and document green remediation best practices, in this case, at a pump and treat site. And hopefully also maybe start developing some performance metrics. How can we track how well we're doing in operating a pump and treat project? And, of course, it will also help build networks of practitioners. And in looking at the registration page, I see there's a lot of people from consulting engineering firms. There are a lot of companies representing probably site owners. There are also state regulators and a lot of international participants. So hopefully this will help build those networks of practitioners and get that knowledge out there. So with that, one background slide. This is a figure we developed a year ago now. This table actually was released with a primer in April of 2008. And what we did is we looked at a series of cost and performance reports. There's an organization called Federal Mediation Technologies Roundtable, and it has a standard process for developing cost and performance reports across treatment technologies. The purpose is to share information for those technologies when federal agencies pay for it. So there are over 400 cost and performance case studies. So we looked at those as well as remedial system evaluations that we've completed in other sources of technology to develop, I guess, a prototype treatment system for pump and treat, thermal desorption, ex situ, multi-phase extraction, air sparging, and solar vapor extraction. And based on the engineering data available on how those systems were built and operated, we developed an estimate average annual energy draw for each of those systems. And then based on the data we have on the frequency of how often these technologies are selected in the Superfund program, we ran an estimate of the energy use through 2030. This analysis is available on the Cluen Green Remediation page if you want to go into the spreadsheets and assumptions, et cetera, that were used to develop this analysis. But the main point to draw from here is that there's an order of magnitude difference between pump and treat and the next most energy-intensive technology, which is thermal desorption, at least based on these five. So it's a good reason for us to, when Dorothy came to us and said that she had a pump and treat project she wanted to look at, the carbon energy footprint and the energy footprint, we thought it was a good candidate. So anyway, that's what we did, and hopefully this seminar will contribute to knowledge on how to operate those systems more efficiently. So slide number 6, recap on the energy and carbon footprint strategy. This is a bigger discussion. Just to recap some of the options that there are in reducing the carbon energy footprint of any cleanup technology across our cleanup programs. We've talked about optimizing systems to maximize efficiency and the return per unit of energy invested. We have been doing that for almost 10 years now with remedial system optimization efforts, building renewable energy capacity at contaminated sites, to power remedies, and there's also a lot of work going on independent of whether or not there's a remedy on the site that requires power. But the concept there is, why put renewables on green fields if we have brownfields that have some type of restricted use, and we could be using them to place our renewable energy generating capacity. So anyway, that's another option of the relationship between contaminated lands and renewable energy and climate change. And, of course, tapping into grid renewable energy portfolios. Many states already have those, so that's one of the options. And finally, an area where a lot of work is being done is leverage carbon sequestration from soil amendment treatment. So what is the potential to capture carbon through soil amendment treatments at sites, and how much carbon does that help us capture and quantify what the offset might be to more energy-intensive remedies elsewhere. So the point is that there are options out there to reduce the carbon and energy footprint of treatment systems without necessarily having to shut them down. So with that said, what are our objectives for Baird and McGuire? Dorothy is going to give you some more background on the site itself, but let me just recap before we get started and get into the history of the site, and then the analysis that we performed to look at the pump and tree system and the options for increasing efficiencies and reducing carbon footprint. Basically, we started off with identifying those alternatives that help us achieve the energy savings, and we want to document the approaches for the carbon footprint analysis at pump and tree site. We know that there are many companies out there working on this, and many project managers developing models to evaluate the carbon footprint at the treatment systems. Well, we want to share the findings from this specific project. We also will explore and share our findings of the potential of coupling combined heat and power turbines with a little bit of background for those of you who are not familiar with those turbines on what combined heat and power is, but what the potential is to power systems, treatment systems with combined heat and power. I think that's a very interesting finding. Of course, there are challenges and questions that we don't have an answer for. We'll share those with you, and hopefully in a discussion after the call, we can get some insight. Somebody is willing or able to share some insight on some of those questions and challenges that are yet to be overcome. And then, of course, as I said, build communication among different areas of expertise, such as energy, site cleanup, and project management. We have some of those represented on the call, but often we found that there is a challenge here. There are people that know a lot about renewable energy but very little about cleaning up contaminated sites, and we have to build that communication across those areas of expertise. So finally, that's the last point we hope to achieve with this call. So with that, I'll hand it over to Dorothy Allen from Massachusetts DEP.
Thank you, Carlos. As Carlos said, I'm Dorothy Allen. I'm a project manager on the site, and I work for MassDEP. Let's see. My presentation is going to be very quick. I'm going to go through the slides very rapidly because I think that probably Doug's part of the presentation will be the most interesting. However, I felt that you needed to understand some of the site background, and I will try to limit my site history just to those areas that I think might be pertinent to what we're trying to evaluate here. So just as a, you should be on slide 8, I'll just, like, in summary, tell you that I'll be trying to cover three things. One is give you very brief site history, basically to give you an understanding how this pump and treat system has functioned over a very long period of time, under very different, varied conditions. The second thing I'll try to do is describe many changes that have occurred at the pump and treat facility in terms of its optimization just before and just after the state assumed operation of the facility, which happened in June of 2004, so we're just under 5 years operating it. And finally, what I'll try to describe is the two treatment units that have not performed as designed, or where the operators and the various consultants have not been able to come up with adequate solutions to operate them in an optimal way. which kind of has led to the idea of using CHP option here. When I first started thinking about combined heat and power for this site, I actually reached out to the EPA's combined heat and power partnership people, but they couldn't perform some of these mass transfer operation kind of calculations, and I was very lucky to find Carlos and Doug, who were not only able to do these calculations on the treatment plant, but were actually familiar with the site itself, so I was very grateful for that. So now just to move on really quickly, on slide 8, you see what the site looks like right now. It's a MapQuest photograph, and you see the treatment plant. It's A, labeled as A, and you have the river B. And basically the plume is located between those two letters. Another interesting feature here is C, which are infiltration basins. That's where the effluent from the treatment plant is disposed and needs to meet stringent NCL requirements and GW1 standards. So let's see. Like I said, I'm going to be going pretty rapidly, okay? So slide 9. The site is one of very, very early sites. The contamination there was from direct discharge to soil and groundwater, and contamination spread through the river sediments. And very, very different contaminants were found at the site. The EPA completed RIFS in 1986. Slide 10. The two major remedial components were incineration and the pump and treat system. The incineration was completed in 1998 and involved burning of a lot of soil. The interesting thing here was that the residual ash was buried on site. Very little of it was stabilized. And the pump and treat system initially served to treat the process flows associated with incineration. Initially, the groundwater was contaminated at very concentrated levels with organics. We even had an LNAPL plume, which has since diminished to a point where we're not actively trying to collect it anymore. So the organic plume is now becoming more dilute. Slide 11. This is, I think, a very dramatic photograph of the span of 10 years, what has been achieved at the site. The left photograph is the incinerator that was operational in 1996, and the right-hand slide is what the site looks like. Well, it would look like in 2006. It's even prettier today. So the site has changed drastically over 25-year history. The objective at the site is to restore the groundwater to drinking water standards. There were drinking water wells just upgrading from the infiltration basins that were shut off in 1983. And the thing that I would like to point out on the left-hand side photograph is that just kind of in front to the north of the incinerator is where the active soil incineration soil excavation is taking place. And E is kind of the area that's slightly darker where the incinerated ash is being spread. And that spreading actually just continued on towards the river. The reason why the soil looks kind of gray is because it was being sprayed by foam to keep down the emissions to the air during incineration. Slide 12. These are the pumping rates that we currently are observing or are able to achieve at the treatment facility. It was designed to treat close to 200 gallons per minute, but I don't think it ever operated at that capacity. We have some old wells, some kind of tired wells, so presently we're pumping only 100 gallons per minute, and many of the wells that we had on site were redeveloped. We lost some of them, and some of the very near-term future work is going to involve installing a few more wells and seeing if we can bring up the pumping rate a little higher. Even with 100 gallons per minute, we can achieve what we think is plume capture, and that's slide 13. We check the groundwater levels every quarter. It's a sad-looking slide. I'm sorry it's so fuzzy. Moving on to 14, our current influent concentrations are just displayed here. I just want to point out we may have the wrong units on the arsenic graph. It should be milligrams per liter. All right, so for as far as VOCs and pesticides concerned, they provide organic load to the treatment plant, but they're actually coming in at below the NCLs or below GW1 standards. The only organics that are above standards very consistently is naphthalene at 800 micrograms per liter and acenaphthalene at 50. So that's relatively dilute in terms of comparisons with NCLs and GW1 standards, and it's probably a lot lower than what most of you have seen. Arsenic is another issue. It's much more consistent and persistent, and it's much higher above its MCL of 10 micrograms per liter. Site 15, the other problem with arsenic is that it's very widespread on the site. This is a plume that was plotted up a couple of years ago. It was the best one that I could quickly put together for this presentation. So it's a little old. while the organic concentrations are steadily decreasing, the plot of the arsenic is kind of staying the same. So with that slide, I'm just kind of ending the description of the site conditions. And moving on to the other phase of my presentation, which is just what the state has been doing in terms of optimizing operations at this facility. And I must say that we haven't really been focusing on energy for most part because we've been trying to minimize costs, and there's just been bigger fish to fry. As you may know, the pump and treat remedies, they revert for operation and maintenance to the state after 10 years of EPA's operation. So that's what happened in June of 2004. And before EPA turned over the operation of this facility to us, the agency performed remedial system evaluations, and they performed that for Baird in 2002. And
Dorothy, if I can, we're in slide 16. Please remember to call out the slide numbers.
Okay. Thank you, Carlos. All right, so as part of the IRC, EPA just identified various system operations that could be improved to achieve lower operational costs. The annual treatment plant O&M costs at the time in 2002 were $3.5 million per year. That may have been redundant. Okay, so now we're on 17. The EPA implemented some of the IRC recommendations and reduced about $1.5 million. When the state took over, we implemented some of the others. We also continued to improve pump and treat operations and did some of the things that were not on EPA's list. And were able to reduce the operating costs to about $1 million. And we're now on slide 18. Most recently what we did is we've done this extraction well redevelopment. Some of these wells were very old and were not redeveloped frequently or at all. We had to replace pressure filter media, and we did some investigations as to what kind of filtration to use. And we performed most recently utility audits with National Grid, and we installed more efficient lighting, the typical audit findings, motion sensors, VFDs on some of the wells. And those improvements are supposed to give us about 7 megawatt hours per month in energy use reduction. The other thing on this slide is just a breakdown of the existing costs. And what I'd like to point out to you is under direct costs, there is a GAC, media figure. It's 65,000 for 8 change outs on the GAC media, and close to 123,000 for energy, which includes the electricity and the natural gas for the site. We flip to slide 19. We were just curious after we implemented the audits what our meter use would be, metered use with the utility, and we were surprised that we did get, not surprised, but we were glad to see that there was a reduction from June to August of 08, which is when the various improvements were made in the lighting and the VFDs. However, if you take a look at the way this plant uses energy, particularly electricity, there's a lot of variability besides. And it's something that we're going to be looking at carefully, and I was just actually thinking maybe we should connect some additional sensors or meters into the SCADA system and be able to track maybe some treatment components and be able to find what treatment components, what treatment operations actually contribute to the total load at any given time. Maybe we could minimize demand payments or something with the utility. But that's kind of future work. It's just something that occurred to us. Alright, finally I'm moving to slide 20. We're almost at the end here. And here we have a very simplified treatment process flow for the plant. We have the metals removal system, precipitation with potassium permanganate, two clarifiers, sludge handling, filter press, the flow after the metals removal goes to biotanks, and we'll talk about them a little bit. Then through the pressure filters, the GACs, and then to the infiltration galleries. The biotanks were actually designed to be activated sludge units, and what they serve as now is somewhat inefficient stripping, aeration. They have aeration in them. They also collect some amount of solids. They're actually very difficult to bypass, and maybe we'll talk about it in the next slide. The other units are the GAC units. They're large GAC units that require very frequent changeouts. All right, so we have a picture on slide 21 of what the biotanks look like. And they're large. They each one has a detention time of 28 hours. They're old. They're starting to break down. They can't be bypassed without compromising pressure filters. They require considerable energy, and they really provide incomplete stripping. The next slide is 22, granular activated carbon units. They require frequent changeouts. Based on the current influent loading by organics, they should be changed out maybe 4 times, but they're right now being changed out 8 times, and that's even after they go through certain amount of stripping through the bio units. So we lose some of the organics through the bio units. The changeout is due to the pressure drop, there's we don't even come close to any kind of breakthrough. Slide 23. Okay, so we're very close to the end. We're planning for the future. Basically, the state must operate this plant for a long time, mainly to treat the arsenic. And what we're also treating is progressively more dilute organic loads. What we have on our plate is really trying to optimize the biotanks and improve the GAC operation. We need to redevelop and get more groundwater pumps to the plant, and maybe optimize extraction well pumping. Just pump the wells we want rather than the wells that we can. And then the final thing, which isn't really the last, it's not the least, is to minimize energy use and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that's really mainly because of, if you flip to the next slide, which is slide 24, you'll see that in the last couple of years, and it's all kind of culminated at the end of last year, the state has just showed how committed it is to trying to address energy and renewables use and energy efficiency by passing these various initiatives and two large pieces of legislation. And I think any of these bullets would probably be just a presentation of its own, and I'm not an expert in any of these, but I do want to point out there's several things to point out here. One is that combined heat and power actually commands a premium, and you can bid it into a forward capacity market and get money for it. And Green Communities Act actually includes an extension of the renewable portfolio standard to include alternative energy portfolio standard. And that includes combined heat and power. So I'm not sure how much it will be worth, but there will be a premium for using combined heat and power. Also, I believe the RPS has been expanded to include groundwater source heat pumps that Doug is going to also introduce in his presentation. Finally, as part of the Global Warming Solutions Act, you can voluntarily report your emissions if you're a company or if you're an agency. And Massachusetts DEP is voluntarily reporting its emissions to the Climate Registry, and that includes Baird-McGuire emissions. They're using general reporting protocol, which doesn't include materials, contributions from materials, which our presentation does do. So what MassDEP is reporting to the Climate Registry for Baird-McGuire is actually a smaller fraction than what we're going to talk about. Finally, the last slide is 25. And the concept of combined heat and power at Baird was really resulted from the focus on energy and greenhouse gas emissions, and resulted from the consideration that the GAC changeouts at 6.45 pounds of CO2 per pound of GAC resulted in a very, very large CO2 load to the atmosphere. Biotanks also had very large energy requirements. I'm just going to let Doug present his part of the presentation. Turns out that there is some uncertainty as to the 6.5 pounds of CO2 per pound of GAC figure. But it's undeniable that this is a figure that needs to be considered, since the feedstock for GAC is coal and it does get oxidized during activation, and we can all talk about that at the end. But the use of CHP at the site would involve elimination of biotanks and the GAC units, addition of air stripping at elevated temperature, addition of engine or turbine to provide the heat and the power, and we would provide for maximum heat recovery. Doug added also the use of the heat pump to this concept as well. So I'm at the end of my part, and I'm turning it over to Doug Sutton. I want to thank you all for paying attention. Okay?
Thank you, Dorothy. I think we'll, since there are some concepts here that roll over to Doug's presentation, I'd like to hold questions till the end. But please jot those down. We have saved a lot of time for discussion, so hopefully we can have an engaging discussion. So, Doug, please continue.
Sure. Thank you, Carlos, and thank you, Dorothy. The first thing I'd like to do is just move to slide number 26 and highlight some of the parameters that we use for this study, both the carbon footprint parameters and the cost parameters. If you look at slide 26, there are four different carbon parameters that we outlined, the pounds of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour of electricity used, and the 12.2 pounds of carbon dioxide per therm of natural gas used. There's the 6.45 pounds of carbon dioxide per pound of GAC that Dorothy mentioned, and I have discussion point written right next to there for the reference, because as she mentioned, that can be quite a variable number. I think that's probably we borrowed that from an EPA Region 3 study, but didn't go into too much detail as to how they generated that number. We did try to go back and back calculate it and try to confirm whether it was reasonable. I think personally I've decided that that's probably a low number if you're looking at virgin carbon, but it may be appropriate or slightly high if you're looking at regenerated carbon, but really uncertain and need more information from manufacturers on that. For the cost parameters, most of that information just came from bills or from contract estimates. So moving to slide number 27, if we use those parameters and we look at the process flow, the simplified process flow diagram that Dorothy presented earlier, we can start to look at what the breakdown of the carbon footprint and the cost is for operating the various components of the treatment system. If we look at the total cost up there, you can see the total cost for operating the system is about $784,000 per year. That doesn't include things like project management or groundwater sampling or consulting or whatnot. That's just basically handling the operations of the treatment plant, including the materials. And the carbon footprint, same thing. It just applies to the treatment plant operations. And the carbon footprint, the total we're looking at is about 787 tons of carbon dioxide per year. And it breaks down according to the chart that we see here. There's a decent amount associated with the extraction and equalization of the water.
Doug, I'm going to ask people could please check that their phones are on mute. Are we getting a lot of interference? Remember that to mute your phones, you can press star 6, and later on for discussion, pound 6 to unmute. So please mute your phones pressing star 6. Thank you.
Okay. So if you look at this chart, the blue is the carbon footprint per year. And, the big items are the extraction and equalization, the inefficient stripping that Dorothy mentioned, the GAC units, and then actually the building, the heating and ventilation associated with the building. The high cost component that people might expect, and most of you probably know, it would be the O&M labor. But if you look beyond that, the next highest component is that GAC. It's just very small compared to the O&M labor. And, of course, it's probably appropriate to spread that O&M labor over the various components. But nevertheless, if you make it a category of itself, it's a big player in cost but not carbon footprint. Moving to the next slide, 28, just a couple of preliminary analysis or conclusions from looking at that breakdown. Obviously, the GAC has a high carbon footprint and a high cost, but that's largely due to the frequent changeouts that Dorothy made. They're changing that carbon out based on fouling or pressure buildup, not on breakthrough. And the O&M labor costs are high, but are low with respect to carbon footprint. So if you're out there looking for cost savings, you might be looking at O&M, but if you're out there looking for a carbon footprint reduction, then you're looking at energy, and it's not always the same thing that you need to be looking at. When looking at the extraction rates and capture zone, Dorothy suggested that things are pretty good there. They've got a pretty good handle on what extraction rate they need. The VFDs are on the extraction pump. So we assume when we look at these various big contributors that it's really not worth putting much more attention into the extraction system, at least for the purpose of this study. So what are the other big components? It's the air stripping and the building footprint that we want to take a look at. Moving to the next slide, number 29. So what are our options with dealing with those components? We can eliminate the stripping and go to a GAC-only treatment for organics and attempt to decrease that GAC changeout frequency. I think that would be the optimal approach. We can eliminate the GAC and go with stripping only. That's another approach, which... for something like naphthalene, it is strippable. It's not your ideal strippable compound, but it does work. And also, we can enhance the stripping with waste heat from combined heat and power, which is actually the idea that that DEP came to us with several months or I don't even know how long, perhaps a year ago. And then also just look at alternatives for building heating and cooling, or primarily heating. So looking at the next slide, number 30. Now let's go ahead and plug in these various options into the spreadsheet we had. The baseline number is not on here, but if it were, remember that was 787 tons of carbon dioxide per year. That's actually off this chart quite a bit. So all these options that I have here, GAC only with a 50% reduction, and air stripping, all provide a good benefit. I mean, if you compare it to that 787, we're talking about a reduction of 100 tons per year for two of those options, and a reduction of close to 200 tons per year for another option. It's just a matter of how do we get there. All of them also have a cost savings associated with them as well, though as you can see, the cost savings is minor compared to the reduction in the carbon footprint. And, of course, that's from the fact that the O&M labor is the big component for the annual cost. So let's look at the next slide. Now, if we were to look at the combined heat and power aspect of it, that's heat-enhanced air stripping. So what is the relationship between water temperature and air stripping? And this is just some output from some vendor software. You can choose the vendor of your choice. This was just using the software from Carbonair. But you can see that if you were to choose an influent concentration of about 800 micrograms per liter, that increasing that temperature gives you a lower and lower effluent concentration. In fact, if you look at the standard that the GW1 standard that Dorothy needs to meet, that's about 140, if I'm not mistaken. And so that 85 to 95 temperature range, you're in good shape there. And I think that 800, from what she told me, is a fairly conservative influent concentration to work on. Wait for the phone to stop ringing.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Uh-huh.
Is someone on the phone?
This is an internet seminar you've just dialed into. If you're not...
I'm sorry.
Here to join, please hang up. Thank you.
Okay, so moving on to slide 32 then. What would a heat-enhanced air stripping system look like? Obviously, any heat that you add to the process water, you'd want to add as close to the heat, to the air stripper as possible so that you're not losing heat along the way, and then you'd want to capture some of that heat and reuse it rather than discharge it to the infiltration basins. So we have a heat source here, presumably a boiler of some sort, natural gas boiler, providing the heat necessary to bring up that water from that water that's coming from the metals removal system. You heat that up to about 85 degrees, apply to the air stripper, and get the removal that we're looking for. Of course, you're going to have some sensible and latent heat losses associated with feeding the water through that air stripper and having it come in contact with all that air. So the effluent from the air stripper will have a lower temperature. And the heat exchanger will help borrow some of that heat and send it back to the inlet of the air stripper so that we're only discharging water that's maybe 50 degrees rather than 80-something degrees. We're reusing a lot of that heat rather than discharging it. And as you can see, just looking at this, a lot of the heat that's going into that pre-air stripper is coming back from that heat exchanger. So that tells you that really, you know, in order to get this type of system to operate, you need to bring it up to temperature, so to speak. You need to recirculate the water several times over before you actually got to a temperature that was going to give you sufficient stripping efficiency, which would certainly be something to consider if you're designing a system like that and something you want to look out for. Moving to the next slide, 33. Well, I think this is the point where we'd want to talk about combined heat and power because that would give us a more energy-efficient way of providing that heat. But let's talk about combined heat and power first just so everyone's on the same page. Combined heat and power is the idea of generating electricity and then using the waste heat from that electricity generation for beneficial purposes rather than just discharging it to the atmosphere. Many of you have probably seen a generator in operation, and the way that it cools itself down if it's a liquid-cooled engine is just to have a radiator and a fan blowing all that heat off to probably outside the building or enclosure. In this case, we'd be talking about a natural gas power generator, but all that waste heat from the radiator and from other components of the system, from the exhaust and whatnot, would be captured and then used for beneficial purposes, in this case, heating that water prior to the air stripper. Now, if you look at the figure over to the right, that gives you an idea of what the benefits of CHP are. If you wanted, say, 30 arbitrary units of electricity and 30 arbitrary units of heat, or I'm sorry, 45 arbitrary units of heat right there in the middle in red, if you were to use typical grid and boiler to provide that, you'd need to use 154 units of energy. But if you were to use a CHP unit, you'd be talking more on the order of 100 units of energy, so you can see the benefit right there. Now, of course, this type of approach really only makes sense if you can balance out that electrical demand and that heat demand. If you don't have the heat demand, then you're going to be generating electricity and have all this waste heat that you can't use. And if you don't have the electrical demand, then you're not going to be able to generate the heat you need. So those need to be balanced. Now, how would this fit into the treatment plan? If we go to the next slide, 34, it's the same layout as before, only we've replaced that boiler with a CHP unit and a small supplementary boiler, kind of like a domestic water heater, something along those that size, one or two of those. Now, if you look at the CHP box in the upper left corner, it's a 75-kilowatt unit. We'd be feeding about 60,000 or 61,000 therms of natural gas per year to that. They would generate quite a bit of electricity for us that we'd use at the system to power pumps and motors and whatnot, and would give us a portion of the heat that we needed, but not all of the heat. And I want to point out here that that CHP unit is not working at full load. There simply is not enough of an electrical demand at the site to generate, to use it at its full capacity. So actually, if there were more of an electrical draw at the site, then we'd generate a little bit more heat and get a little bit more bang for our buck. But we're just short of that, actually. Other than that, this slide is the same. We're still using a heat exchanger to bring some of that heat back to the front of the air stripper. So what does this approach do for us? What does heat-enhanced air stripping do for us? Let's compare it on slide 35 to, say, the GAC-only option. And if you remember from the previous slide, the GAC-only option and the air stripping option were very similar in performance. Their carbon footprints were almost identical, and their costs were somewhat comparable. I think actually the air stripping cost was a little bit less than the carbon in this case. But for both, for the boiler option, the one right in the middle, the one that's just traditional heat enhanced, you can see it's just plain a terrible option. The costs aren't that great, and the carbon footprint's actually higher than the baseline. So it certainly doesn't make sense to go with that option. But if you look at the CHP option, we're cutting another 90, tons of carbon dioxide off per year, from the system. So certainly benefit there and a marginal savings in cost as well. So, it actually does, show some merit. The idea that DEP had come up with, that Dorothy had come up with, actually has some merit to it, and was worth looking into. If we go to the next stage, now this has given us some options for dealing with the GAC and the airstripper and whatnot. But what about that building footprint? What is there something that we can do with that? And that's where the heat pump idea comes in. So if we look at slide number 36, we'll start talking about the heat pump technology. And I don't want to go into too much detail on the slide. We can always come back to it if we need to during the discussion period. But the idea is using a heat pump to take some of that water at the effluent. Remember that effluent is going to be about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Take some of that heat and bring it back to the front of the air stripper or use it in the building for heating the building. A heat pump in many ways works just like a refrigerator or an air conditioner, but it's kind of the reverse idea. With a refrigerator, obviously you're trying to cool down the refrigerator, but you're doing that at the expense of heating up the back of the refrigerator. Or with an air conditioner, you're cooling the inside of your building at the expense of rejecting heat out through that compressor unit outside your building. It's much the same concept, only here we're looking at, we actually want to heat something at the expense of cooling something else off. So it's very much the same approach. The other difference here is that we're using water as our source of heat rather than air. And we can, like I said, we can come back to this slide and go over it in a little bit more detail if we need to, but it's the same kind of concept as an air source heat pump, only we're using water. And this slide here, if you're looking at it in any kind of detail, it only shows the heating mode. Water source heat pumps are also capable of providing, by changing some valves around, are also capable of providing cooling to a building, which you typically don't need in a pump and treat system because of all the water flowing through the building anyway. So let's move on to slide number 37 and see how this might work for us. This is putting that CHP unit and the heat pump, working those both into the system. If we look at the CHP unit, you see the numbers are slightly different than what we showed before. And the reason for that, they're higher. There's a higher natural gas usage, a higher electrical generation, and a higher heat generation. And the reason for that is because the heat pump is an electrical unit. It's, I think we spec'd out a 18-kilowatt system for that. So that's using quite a bit more electricity, and that additional electricity allows our CHP unit to operate at a higher or closer to 100% load. So we're using basically as much as we can get out of that. So we're providing a little bit more heat to the process flow from the CHP unit, and then that heat pump is also giving us some more heat to either heat the building and or add heat to the process stream. And you can note here, rather than at that in that heat pump box, you can see that the water temperature coming into that's about 50 degrees, and the water temperature leaving is about 40 degrees. So we're actually cooling that water off a little bit compared to what was coming into the system. So what does this do for us? Let's look at slide number 38. Plug all that information into our spreadsheets and run our calculations, and we see that what extra that gives us. The GAC-only option is still provided there for comparison. The CHP option is there, and then the CHP option with the heat pump are there. And you can see there's a marginal savings in cost, and you can also see that there's another 60 tons of CO2 per year that we save by going with this heat pump approach, which is a nice feature. So certainly, I guess that would be the optimal in terms of reducing carbon footprint. Of course, there's some technology issues to work into a system like that. If we move to the next slide, number 39, we can start to look at what kind of reductions we're talking about. Obviously, when a lot of agencies or in terms of meeting mandates, often we're required to reduce our carbon footprint by a certain percentage by a certain time. So what would these various options that we're looking at give us in terms of footprint reduction? The simple ones, the GAC only or air stripping options, give us pretty decent reduction. 16% is not shabby at all. The CHP options and even the CHP option with a heat pump gives us a 35% reduction, which is really outstanding. Other point of interest on this slide is look how big a difference there is between the reduction in the carbon footprint versus the reduction in the annual O&M cost, and that's certainly just reflective of energy cost as being a relatively small portion of annual O&M costs. Once again, with the labor taking the majority of the cost. So let's move to the next slide, number 40, and we can start looking in terms of payback. I've mentioned annual costs and showed some savings there, but obviously these different things take some money to implement. So what would be the payback for them? This slide is organized with the baseline to the left and then those options with a smaller and smaller carbon footprint going to the right. And, you know, I think the straightforward, looking at the slide, I think any consultant or agency would hone in on that GAC-only option with a 50% reduction if it were possible, because it gives you the best bang for your buck in terms of CO2 reduction, and it also gives you a very good payback. That payback is small because there's relatively little you'd need to do to bring out just going to a GAC-only option, especially given that my understanding is that DEP is looking at removing those bio units anyway. So the other costs that might be needed should be relatively small compared to the savings you'll be getting from going to a GAC-only or a GAC-only with a 50% reduction. The air stripping option, the payback is respectable. I think, you know, many organizations might go with a 7-year payback. But if you're looking, if the GAC only option with a 50% reduction doesn't pan out, then an organization is faced with looking at either the GAC only option or the air stripping option, or investing some more money with a worse payback to get the additional savings of 100 to 150 tons of carbon per year. And that really would be something that management would have to decide, is how much is that carbon footprint really worth to them. You know, the CHP unit looks like it has a payback of about 10 years, and given that equipment tends to wear out and things like that, we'd have to assume that really the CHP unit is just paying for itself. And then the CHP unit with the heat pump, it's paying for itself. I mean, the payback's also close to 10 years, so in a sense you're just paying. It's paying for itself, but giving you a decent reduction in carbon footprint. Once again, that's a decision that management would need to make based on their priorities. moving to slide 41, we can now start talking about some of our conclusions and where the site might want to go. I think a lot of engineers would agree that the first thing you want to do is look at that GAC performance, see if there's a way you can improve that. Look at the clarifier sizing. One of the reasons why they're getting the fouling is perhaps due to overflow from the clarifier. That might also be solved by looking at metals removal chemistry, polymers or oxidants and whatnot. Filter effectiveness. I was just talking with Dorothy relatively recently, and that filter effectiveness, the pressure filters are not really doing what they would hope they would do. And then backwashing of the carbon, are they doing that frequently enough? Are they getting enough bed expansion and whatnot? If those work out, then I think the direction is pretty clear. If those don't work out, if the GHG reduction doesn't work out, then you can start looking at the piloting air stripping with and without the heating. And, you know, vendor software shows you some things, but it's always worth giving it a try in reality before moving forward with a decision. If the air stripping alone gives you good options and it doesn't merit going with heating, then you might save that extra infrastructure and hassle with a more complicated system. And then obviously you can decide whether or not you want to move forward with a CHP option as well to give you that extra bang for your buck in carbon footprint reduction. One of the issues that just came up near the end of this study is that I've recognized that some states are substantially reducing their naphthalene criteria. I know Oregon is one of them, for example. Their naphthalene criteria is going down to about one rather than the 140 that they have right now in Massachusetts. And if that were the case, then the air stripping or the heat enhanced air stripping would just not get you anywhere close. You'd have to go with a carbon type option. So that's something that is certainly, I wouldn't want a system designed and installed that ends up working for a couple of years and then we find out that it's just not capable of meeting standards that are coming down the pike. So it's something to keep our eyes out for as DEP makes a decision on where to go. And then the idea that the water source heat pump, it might be a decent option for the building regardless of whether or not they go with the CHP unit. But one thing to consider is that there is extra heat coming out of that effluent at 50 degrees because of the CHP option. And if that CHP option isn't there, then they're using the heat pump on 45-degree water, which it will have a lower efficiency. So it would be something to study before just going ahead and implementing it. We also have some conclusions regarding the footprint analysis, and that's on slide 42. We mentioned before that the labor has a high cost but a relatively low footprint, and the electricity and energy is relatively low cost but has a high footprint. So you're looking at different things if you want to reduce your footprint versus reduce cost, depending on what your focus is. Materials can have a high footprint. In this case, I think the carbon we've demonstrated has a fairly high footprint. It's worth focusing on that option. And it's also important to know what the footprints are of those individual materials. You can see here they use very little permanganate for the oxidation and their metals removal, but there are several other systems and perhaps in situ remedies that might use a lot more permanganate or a lot more of another reagent, and you would want to know what those footprints are of those reagents if you're interested in getting the footprint of your overall remedy. And these materials are they're a lot harder to figure out what their footprint is compared to just typical energy or electricity usage. So there's a couple of notes there at the bottom regarding the GHG footprint and the idea that a lot of that footprint comes from using coal as a feedstock, and there are certainly reasons for that. But if there are renewable options to use as a feedstock, such as coconut shells, whatever else, that might help in terms of reducing carbon footprint if that's what their clients are interested in seeing. And moving on to 43, and this is our final slide. What are the conclusions regarding technological applications? Clearly, the CHP option, combined with some heat exchangers, is a pretty efficient method of heating process water, whether that's needed for maybe enhancing a biological treatment system or enhancing air stripping, or whether it's needed for in-situ remedies. That combined heat and power option is shows you some savings both in terms of money and carbon footprint. But of course, if you're going to look at an option like that at a pump and treat system, you want to make sure you're looking at an optimized pump and treat system first. You want to compare that combined heat and power not to the baseline, but to where can you get reasonably easily, say like the GAC only option or the air stripping only option. That's what you want to compare it to rather than comparing it to the current situation. And the other thing is that we were looking at CHP here for removal of naphthalene. And, naphthalene is, fortunately, relatively easily remediated with or removed with carbon. but there are other contaminants out there that aren't suited so well for stripping or for carbon removal, maybe MTBE. And the heat-enhanced removal or heat-enhanced stripping for MTBE might be much more appropriate given that the other options aren't as great. And then finally, I think you want to look at the some of the disadvantages of heating water before you actually move forward with that. You have the potential for increasing of scaling or fouling, and also what I mentioned before in terms of bringing a system up to temperature before getting the efficiencies that you're looking for. So certainly you want to keep those in mind. And then the heat pump idea in terms of extracting some of that heat from the effluent, or in the case of cooling, storing some of that heat in the effluent, might be a worthwhile endeavor for several pump and treat systems out there. And so with that slide, I've just shared three slides of conclusions with you. That wraps up my presentation, and consistent with Carlos's desire, we've got plenty of time for discussion.
Thank you so much, Doug. We'll start taking some questions now. For those of you on the Internet, remember that you can click on the question button at the top of the page to submit a question at any point. And for those of you on the phone, of course, if you are on mute and would like to ask a question, remember to press #6 to unmute your phone. So let me first take it to the phone lines to see if there are any questions that people might have for either Doug or Dorothy. Okay, I'll go with the first question on that we received over the Internet, and this, I presume, is for Dorothy. The question is, to which Global Warming Solutions Act and decrease of 10-25% by 1990 by 2020 is slide 24 referring to? If you could please specify.
Hang on. Let me go to the slide. Global Warming Solutions Act, that was a state a statute that was passed the fall of 1998. Don't recall exact date. It was announced in the fall. It's a state statute.
Thank you, Dorothy.
And right now, as a matter of fact, I mean, just to follow it up, right now they're both of these acts are being implemented under emergency regulations, and I think that the real regulations will be promulgated sometime in the spring of this year, and I think they are DEP and DOER. DOER, I believe, is handling the Clean Communities Act, and DEP is handling the Global Warming Solutions Act, and they have stakeholder meetings.
Thanks, Dorothy. Again, back to the phone lines. Any questions on the phone lines?
Yes, Doug. How did you handle the cost of the electricity generated? Was it generated at a premium to a normal cost of electricity you could get from a utility, and did you add those costs to the treatment system? How did you handle that?
The electricity cost of 17 cents per kilowatt hour, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
That's directly from the bill. That handles the electricity generation and distribution charge that that the utility is charging the site. Comes straight off the bill. It does not include a demand charge. So I suppose I could have averaged out the demand charge to include that in there. But that is basically the usage charge that they're charged in Massachusetts. It's in that part of Massachusetts. It's actually higher than what I experience here in New Jersey, and probably higher than a lot of people around the country are used to. But that's what it is.
And actually,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Maybe more direct question, comparing the cost of electricity generation through the combined heat and power process, what would that cost be, and is it a positive or negative impact on the cost of operating the system?
All the options that I showed there with the combined heat and power, it actually showed a decrease in cost. So that gave you a lower cost. Now, of course, part of that was because you were actually using fewer blowers, fewer air strippers to provide you the removal that you needed. So that's why that option was cheaper. But if you're looking at just plain old electricity generation, you're not going to do as well with the CHP unit, simply because you've got some capital costs there, and you're not going to do anything better with that. But you know, the real benefit from the CHP comes when you have a use for that waste heat. I mean, if I had a choice of having a natural gas power generator on site versus using grid power, I'd go ahead and use the grid power. It would be cheaper. You don't have to deal with equipment maintenance and things like that. And actually, the overall cost that I showed you there for, like, say, the CHP unit did include extra O&M time for, say, a service tech. I had an extra service tech visit in there once per week, which is something you'd want to consider if you have machinery like that operating.
Thanks, Doug. We'll take a question over the Internet. I think you answered this on the last slide, but let's put it back out there for further clarification. The question is, would you please repeat your comment about the GAC emission value? Did you say this number is 6.45 pounds per pound? Would it be an overestimate for GAC regeneration and an underestimate for GAC reactivation?
What I was coming up with when I was trying to back out numbers that I found from Internet searches and whatnot, is I came up with that for virgin carbon, I was seeing well over 10 pounds of CO2 per pound of GAC for virgin carbon, probably maybe up in the 12 or 15, but my numbers are just too uncertain to give you a specific on that, but certainly well over 10 for virgin carbon. Now, every time you go back to regenerate that, you lose a little bit, but you also are only spending the cost of the transportation and the regeneration rather than the whole activation process. So if you can regenerate carbon, you know, 10 times over or 5 times over or whatnot, you start to get down to that 6.45 number or less. But
thanks.
My numbers are too uncertain to give you any more than that.
And there's a subsequent question that relates to that, so I'll just put it out there. It's the please clarify GAC statements about materials and CO2 emissions. Did your estimates include both actual material as well as the energy required to regenerate, reactivate it, or did it include only the energy requirements for regeneration, and also to factor in things like transportation of the GAC back and forth for the regeneration?
Yeah, I had numbers in there for mining the coal, and then I had numbers in there for carbonizing the coal, and then I had numbers in there for activating the char into activated carbon, and then we had I had a number in there for just other electrical usage or energy usage that might happen at a plant, and then I had some numbers in there for the transport. And honestly, the mining and the transport costs are really minimal compared to, or at least according to the way I handled it, were really minimal compared to the quantity that's coming off of the activation process. As Dorothy mentioned, the activation process, from what we can glean, is that you're taking coal and you're carbonizing, which means you're heating it in the absence of oxygen, and that brings you down to more pure carbon per se. And then at that point, you need to activate it with steam. And in that process, you're removing quite a bit of the carbon and oxidizing, and it goes out to the atmosphere. So you're actually generating a lot of carbon dioxide just from the activation process. And it's not so much that you're using energy to do it, it's just that you're actually, you know, taking some of the carbon from the coal and sending it straight out into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So that's the biggest component of the footprint for GAC. And certainly, as you go back to the regeneration process, the regeneration takes a lot less, has a much smaller footprint than the activation process. So the more you regenerate it, the lower the overall footprint. And I just want to qualify all these statements that I'm not an expert on GAC generation or activation and generation. It's what I could glean from some library and Internet research. I think that hopefully someone in the GAC manufacturing process will be able to step up and provide us some more exact information so that we're not subject to this guess.
Yeah, and if I'd like to jump in here also and say that this goes for all the other treatment chemicals that we're using, not just for GAC. I think that it would be really very worthwhile and beneficial if industry people would, without jeopardizing their confidential business information, provide enough information about the actual manufacturing processes so that we could really adequately and in a very open kind of environment evaluate which treatment options are really sustainable from the CO2 emissions perspective.
Right. So, and that's a really good point. I mean, for example, if you wanted to compare pump and treat to an in situ chemical oxidation remedy, A lot of the aspects of pump and treat, especially if you're dealing with, say, air stripping, it's very easy to get that footprint because you're really just relying on what the footprint is for the electricity. Many of the other components are pretty minor. But if you look at what's the footprint of that, of say the permanganate or the peroxide or whatever else that you're injecting into the subsurface, we really don't have a good handle on those. We'd have to go through the process that we just did for the GAC, which is you try to understand the manufacturing process and you try to back out some of those numbers, but ultimately, you know, it's very uncertain unless someone from the actual manufacturer starts providing more information. And in that sense, it's very difficult to compare the carbon footprint of those two different types of remedies.
Thank you, Doug. We'll go to the phone lines. Any questions on the phone lines? Then a question from the Internet. This might be for you, Dorothy, more about operating the site itself. It's a two-part question. What was the site originally used for? And the second part is, how far along is remediation in light of the options being considered for continued remediation?
What was the site used for? You know, the descriptions that I've read, this goes way before I was born. Not really, no. But it was discovered in 83. And it was a batching facility. It was manufacturing inks, pesticides, paints, those kinds of things. I think the arsenic was from pesticide batching process.
And the second part was, what are the options being considered for continued remediation?
You know, we've been thinking, there is very persistent arsenic there, and there's some thought that it's really coming from a continued source of the ash that's there. And there's been some thought that the reason why it's in this soluble form is because there's kind of a reducing environment in the groundwater, and you get the arsenite instead of the arsenate, and perhaps that once we treat and remove all the organics, the arsenic will precipitate out, and we would it will kind of disappear. You know, from all the time that I've been involved with the site, I haven't seen a reduction of that plume. So I think we're locked into a pump and treat scenario for a good long time, unless we come up with some other solution. You know, someone proposed in situ oxidation to remove the organics and really that and the precipitate the arsenic, and I really think the organics are really licked here. I mean, they will be gone. The arsenic, we don't really have a good handle on that. Most of the site is a wetland, and it's also in the 100-year floodplain. Maybe now it's in the 50-year floodplain. It'll soon be in the 25-year floodplain. But so I don't know whether you can really tap it. Right now we're pumping and treating, and we're trying to do it as economically as possible and as efficiently as we can.
Thanks, Dorothy. We have a question here that I know it was discussed several times throughout the project. I guess it would be both for Doug and for Dorothy. The point is, in order to help balance the power supplied and the heat generation needed, did you evaluate the economics of generating more power than needed and selling the power back to the grid? So would that help balance out, for example, if you had a greater heat demand than power demand, getting a CHP that was exceeded your generating capacity and selling the remainder back to the grid?
Well, I think the value in the on-site generation is that you're offsetting the void cost, which is your retail price. Once you start selling electricity to the grid, you know, you go through some kind of a power purchase agreement, and I don't think the prices are favorable. I think you're going to get a premium. You know, I think you'll do better if you avoid the retail cost and if you get some kind of a premium through an ATS program.
And if I can point out, when this discussion has come up, we're starting work on another project where there may be an on-site source of gas, in this case methane. So in those situations, all this equation starts to make a lot more sense. The way it's been structured here, this discussion, this presentation, this analysis, it assumes that that the site would be purchasing natural gas off the market. Just a comment, Doug, we have from a colleague of yours at CH2M. The point of reference on CO2 for carbon, they estimated 5.75 pounds of CO2 per pound of carbon generated, so it looks pretty close.
That's what CH2M used?
Yes.
And could we ask whether they've looked at what kind of burn-off they've kind of considered for the activation process?
Or I guess in general what the assumptions were, or where they get their number.
Yep.
Okay, we have a point of contact. We can follow up. I appreciate that comment. A question here is whether you have considered solar thermal for preheating water.
I'm so glad that question came up. I've looked into this. I've actually made contact with a company. It's called Zenith Solar. I'm not plugging them at all. It's something that I just happened to see in the newspaper, and I started talking to them. And they have a dish of mirrors that with like I think 10 or 100 centimeters squared solar panel, and they generate electricity and a lot of heat, and it's rather a small device by solar standards, and they're right now testing it out in the deserts of Israel. But I think there may be some other technologies like that. What's also really interesting for those people that maybe manage small plumes, small pieces of contamination, is micro-CHP. Honda makes micro-CHP units that I think they generate like 1 kilowatt and I want to say 12,000 BTUs. But okay, they're under Freewatt logo. Climate Energy is another, I think that's the company name.
Just a comment on the solar thermal. I think it's a fantastic idea. The one thing that you would want to consider with that versus the CHP is you wouldn't want that to be your only source of heat simply because of the variability between, say, winter months, cloudy days, non-cloudy days, cold outside temperatures, warm outside temperatures. You'd want to definitely have either a boiler there or the CHP unit there to augment and help stabilize that temperature or that heating.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's some engineering work involved.
Questions from the phone lines, please.
John?
Yes?
This is Ginny Lombardo from Region 1.
Hi, Ginny.
And this, I guess this question goes to the state person, too. Can you just say what the levels of arsenic are? And for the, it seems like the first step is going to be the performance evaluation for the granular activated carbon. I was wondering why that evaluation wasn't done as part of this, if it seems like that's what's really causing all the problems with the GAC. Why wasn't that the process before that seems to be following that system already evaluated and looking for solutions to that problem?
Okay. First question is the arsenic one. It's coming in around 400 micrograms per liter, very consistently, in the insulin. And, you know, the GAC optimization, it's something that the entire 15 years that the site has been in operation, various operators, consultants, to EPA, to the Army Corps of Engineers, oversight contractors for EPA, the state operators have been working on. It's not something that, performing this kind of calculations for the CHP, there are theoretical things. It's something that can be done fairly quickly when you're starting to run pilot and changing and repiping the system to test your theory as to why the GAC isn't working as designed. That takes a long time. And we've already run some things. We've already tried some things that have been tried before. And you know, different polymers were tried. Bypassing the biunits was tried. Different types of filter media were tried. Biocide at $100,000 a year was tried. So we're right now that we have some ideas. Doug and I have been talking about what can we try next, and it's still something that will certainly precede anything we would actually move on at the site with the actual design and implementation. But it's not like everybody's been sitting here watching the site do this without attempting some kind of a remedy.
Thanks, Dorothy. A question here that I think Doug touched on briefly. It's how would you approach a pump and treat site that hasn't had any previous optimization work with respect to reduction in the remediation footprint?
I mean, I think it's somewhat consistent with what we're doing with you, Carlos, which is that when you evaluate a system, it's best to combine what we refer to as a remediation system evaluation or some sort of analog where you're looking at optimizing that treatment plan or what the various low-hanging fruit is in terms of improving operations and reducing cost and maintaining effectiveness, and then also putting on top of that the green component of it, the carbon footprint component of it. I really think that both of those analyses can be done together rather than separately. I mean, certainly as long as you have experts in both aspects of it on the same team, then it's going to save you money in doing both of those evaluations at the same time. In terms of getting your site contractors there to, and operators there to answer questions and having the team there just once. But yeah, I think both of those things should be done in concert, unless you already have a fairly well optimized system that can then just be a baseline for carbon footprint and then tackled again. But I really think that both evaluations can be done at the same time. In fact, that's what we're doing with EPA now at almost a standard practice.
There's another related question, which is very much in line with the concept that green remediation or green cleanups is more than just energy and carbon. Let's see how we tackle this one. The question is, at your site, you have infiltration galleries. Have you accounted for this groundwater, quote-unquote, usage if you discharge to a POTW?
We've discussed with Holbrook doing that, and not very seriously because their immediate response is, no, we really don't want this. And the problem is somewhat perception, I think, in that the site has had, you saw the picture of the incinerator. This was an extremely controversial site. And you notice how close the incinerator was to actual neighborhoods, residential neighborhoods. And so from the public perception, there's just a memory in that community of how bad the site was, and people don't really want organics or arsenic or anything going into their treatment system.
Thanks,
Lily. Actually, you know what, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think I do recall it. I'm just trying to remember whether I was talking with town people or whether it was NWRA. I think they may actually be serviced by NWRA, and these are discussions with NWRA.
There's also something to be said for maintaining or saving POTW capacity. There's many communities around the country that want to maintain that capacity for other uses. And as far as infiltration, that water's pretty much discharging right back to the stream, so it's not like that water is being beneficially used for some other purpose.
Thanks, Doug. Questions on the phone lines, please? Okay, we have one more question on the Internet. It's pretty straightforward. When was this analysis completed? And has Massachusetts DEP made a decision about which optimization approach they'll be pursuing?
I've made some preliminary presentations here, and we're going to be making a few more presentations. The analysis hasn't completed as far as Doug is pretty sure, and And I went through the numbers too, and I feel pretty sure that he's done a really good job. So we're going to be presenting this this information to the management. And what will probably happen with this is that we will work on several things concurrently. I think we will be working on trying to get the GACS to work properly, and at the same time probably do some kind of a pilot test, and at the same time try to find out what the true GACS value is. Those are kind of the three things that are that I think that are kind of paramount to accomplish before a decision.
Thank you, Dorothy. Well, I think with that, we've answered all the questions that came in over the Internet. I'll leave it open in case somebody else has a question. Please feel free to ask on the phone lines.
Yeah, this is Rose Forbes. I'm calling from the Massachusetts Military Reservation, and I'm here with our CH2M Hill team. And we did submit a question. We were asking if you had considered using reactivated carbon instead of virgin carbon. Did you get that?
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought the question had been answered by another question, but
I'm sorry. I guess we didn't hear that.
No, that's okay. Thanks. We can answer it. So the question again was that reactivated carbon has a lower carbon footprint. Now, we consider using reactivated carbon. Is that correct?
Yes, and a lower cost as well. It can be anywhere from 25% to 50% cheaper.
That is what we're using now, and actually we're thinking of switching back to something that's got larger size. That's one of the things we will test that maybe some other type of carbon would be better than the reactivated carbon that we're using now.
Huh.
We have the same issue with the reactivated carbon that we have with the virgin carbon. We just don't really know what the footprint is. We can make some assumptions based on the research we're able to do, but we really need participation from the industry.
I can provide you with some of that information because we did look at it. And are you paying $1 per pound for reactivated carbon?
Yep, that's the we don't see it. It's the contractor that's paying it, but that's
okay.
What we're told.
Okay, just so you know, we pump and treat 15 million gallons per day here. We have eight treatment plants and a number of carbon vessels, and we pay about 50 cents a pound for carbon.
Yeah, it might also be due to the volume you guys have, too.
Yeah,
it's per pound.
No, I meant the amount that you're changing out. I'm not really sure, but I think Dorothy informed me that the dollar per pound she was using was basically the contract estimate they had from their...
Wow. Well, okay.
No, we'd be very glad if you could send us that information. I mean, please email me as much as you can. It will help out.
Sure, I'll email you our carbon supplier, too, if you're interested in that. You can talk
to them. Do you know what feedstock they use?
It's, we have it custom segregated reactivated, so we basically recycle our carbon, and then they have to add in to make up for some of the loss. So they add about 2,000 pounds of virgin carbon for a 20,000-pound load of
reactivated.
Yeah.
Yeah, remember right there, you're talking about a 20,000-pound load, whereas they're getting 8,000-pound loads at Barry McGuire, so that accounts for some of the cost difference.
Oh, possibly.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions on the phone lines?
Yeah, Doug, you had a bullet here on slide 43 that talks about heat pumps for building heating and cooling.
Uh-huh.
Did you look at that as a standalone option for this site?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I noted it that it could be a standalone option. I didn't go through all the calculations for it as a standalone option, but I certainly did, have it in the back of my mind and just noted that it could be thought of as one. The one issue is you start to, at 45 degrees, you start to get around that temperature where you don't really use that. You don't really use water for water source heat pumps below 45 degrees. Unless they're part of like a closed geothermal heat pump system where you can include some antifreeze, so it definitely could be considered here, but you're going to want to factor in that the efficiency is going to be a bit less given that you're using a lower water temperature and you don't want that to go you don't want that to go below freezing and frost things up.
Now, is this 45 degree temperature coming out of those bioreactors, or is this coming out of the ground?
That's coming out of the ground. The bioreactors, it's kind of a misnomer because those bioreactors are not really bioreactors. They were designed as that back in the day, but I think they, early on they realized that they weren't really functioning well as bioreactors. You had to add too much nutrient in order to get the removal you wanted. So they basically just used them as inefficient air strippers for the past however many years, just turning on the blowers and using the aeration from that for removal. So they aren't bioreactors. They're just basically pass-through vessels with air coming through them, which... but yeah, that's the 45 degrees coming out of the water, out of the ground, rather.
And they also settle out some solids. We tried bypassing them, and the filters fall up really quickly. So I think that the way the clarifiers were designed, they weren't designed to go straight to a filter. They were designed to go to those bio units. So, you know, one of the things that we were discussing with Doug is just maybe running the clarifiers differently than the run right now, or maybe sizing them up or doing something with the clarifiers.
Yeah, it's actually a two-stage metals removal process. They go through one metals removal, then they go through that clarifier, then they go through another metals removal stage, which actually is just a pass-through because there's nothing added to it there, and then it goes through another clarifier, and it's pretty clear from their turbidity information that those clarifiers are undersized for the removal that they need. And we were just talking about perhaps instead of running those in series, running them in parallel so that you can actually have a lower flow through each one of them, maybe get better removal out of that, because basically those bio units are serving as they're accumulating quite a bit of solids. And what Dorothy was saying is that when they turn the air off on those units, well, first of all, when they bypass them, all the solids that were settling out in them were still going to the pressure filters, and the pressure filters weren't doing a very good job, so it was going right to the GAC. And then if they actually just let the water flow through the bio units without the aerators on, then they were getting a lot of solids build up in there, and eventually they'd have to turn the whole system off and go in and with confined space entry and clean it all out, which is certainly not effective. So those bio units are really a frustrating component of that remedy. And the lack of appropriate clarification, I think, from the original clarifiers. So I think they're just undersized, which is something I've seen in several instances. Clarifiers are often undersized.
Did I hear somebody asking a question?
I had a question about the frequency of changeouts of the carbon. That may have been said, but I don't recall hearing it. How frequently is the carbon changed out at this point?
It's on the slide, actually. I included the changeout schedule. Last year was 8 times.
Okay. Yes, at the bottom of, I believe it's on slide 22.
Yeah, it's far more frequent than you would get from chemical removal. And they're definitely changing out on pressure buildup, and it really seems to be solids that are making its way out of the clarifiers through the pressure filters and into the carbon that just loading them up too fast.
It was based simply on chemical loading. How frequently do you think that would be?
Probably once a year.
Okay.
No, hang on a second. I think it was in your RSC report, Doug, that you said that the loading was what's in the influence that they would be changed out 4 times.
Right, but your loading has dropped off substantially since then. Right? I mean, I just threw out that one. I almost had to do a calculation for it, but it's substantially lower than the 8. And that, remember that RSC report was back when you actually had
cancer
VOC
yeah.
constituents and everything else too.
Well, that was the last time anyone did the calculation.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're at an hour and a half. It looks like the questions have slowed down. We don't have any pending on the internet. So we've all invested some good time in this. We appreciate the high turnout we have had and the good response to this internet seminar. Particularly like to appreciate Dorothy's willingness to come forward and share her thoughts and her questions and what she's exploring with all of us, and of course the good work that Doug Sutton has put in supporting us with this in helping Dorothy out. So as I mentioned earlier, we expect this internet seminar will be archived. The audio will be packaged together with the slides, and it should be up in a couple of weeks. We do request that if you could fill out the evaluation forms on slide 46. We've also included some additional resources relevant to this webpage. Of course, as you know, the green remediation page on kluin.org/greenremediation. You can also find links to site profiles, documents, technical resources, past seminars, announcements on future seminars, and other work that's going on. There's a lot of activity going on in this, in the topic of green remediation slash green cleanups. But with that, let me again thank you for your participation and request that you kindly complete the feedback form. Your feedback is read very carefully and does help us a lot in defining topics and improving these internet seminars. So again, thank you, Doug. Thank you, Dorothy. And thank all of you who participated. Bye-bye.